Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 3rd, 2026. I'm Jean, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Sue Ann Babcock, Nancy Clausen Bothfeld, Beverly J. Byers, Mario Robert Caraveo, Bonnie Jean Corrigan, Carmen Erasia Esparza, Nathan Tyler Figueroa, Kathy Sue Hamilton, Paul Stanley Harter, Donna L. Hunt, Leonard Coy Macy, Taylor Ann Mobley, Geneva Elise Robinson, Manuel Garcia Rodriguez, James Lewis Chamadon, Alan Sabransky, Alvaro Guadalupe Vega, James Curtis Warwick, Edward J. Williams, and Janet Yee Wong. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. Now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. It looks like there's two of them. The first article is entitled Monetizing Social Media. This was written by Ryan Cormier for the Delaware News Journal out of Wilmington, Delaware. In the 2010 film, The Social Network, which dramatizes the creation of Facebook, co-founder Mark Zuckerberg lays out his early vision for the social media network that would soon become an integral part of American life. Quote, "People want to go online and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that?" Unquote. He asked that of Jesse Eisenberg, who played his friend in the Academy Award-winning film. 22 years after Facebook launched for college students, those innocent, heady days when social media meant little more than sharing pot photos and pet photos and birthday wishes, well, they're often hard to remember. Facebook itself is as much a media content site with its news feed and its reels as it is a place for graduation pictures. Throw in a whirlwind of lawsuits and bans and scandals, and the site is just as controversial as it is influential. As Facebook grew, so did its parent company. It was rebranded as Meta Platforms, Inc. in 2021. Now valued at $1.63 trillion, Meta's ascent was fueled largely by multi-billion dollar acquisitions of brands like Instagram, WhatsApp, and Oculus AR. It has made Meta a rare, iconic American company, one that doesn't sell a physical product, joining the modern counterparts like Google, Netflix, Visa, MasterCard, and Oracle, as well as the more veteran corporations like AT&T, and the broadcast television networks, and the insurance companies like MetLife and Prudential. Meta's scale sets it apart from most other trillion-dollar companies, which typically generate revenue by selling physical goods or direct consumer services. Instead, Meta earns the vast majority of its revenue from advertising, effectively monetizing attention. Well, this story is part of the Iconic Brands series. It's a USA Today network project showcasing the companies and the brands that helped shape the nation's identity, economy, and culture. The series celebrates American ingenuity with a deeply reported examination of how brands intersect with history and community and everyday life in celebration of the nation's 250th anniversary. Selection of companies in the Iconic Brand series emphasized historical significance or industry-building innovation with measurable economic influence and lasting cultural impact. Brands were chosen for transforming daily life or becoming enduring symbols of American values. Long-term relevance and sustained national influence carried greater weight than short-term financial performance or recent popularity. You can find out more by going to their website, usatoday.com/USA250/iconic-brands. Nicholas Meyer, known as the social media professor at Chapman University, Nicholas said, quote, "They have an audience hooked on their product, and advertisers are going to pay to get a sliver of that attention," unquote. At the heart of the conversation around Facebook is the company's monetization strategy. That's a reliance on algorithms that seem to favor more sensational content to maximize user engagement. Amplifying divisive content, teamed with an infinite scroll and notifications, has led to accusations of creating addictive and habitual usage patterns. Lindsay Hoffman, a University of Delaware Communications Associate Professor and the Director of Public Engagement for the Center for Political Communication, Lindsay said, quote, "You don't have to be a social scientist or a psychologist to know what keeps people coming back," unquote. As Meta's original brand, Facebook is its best-known anchor. It was launched in 2004, a year after Zuckerberg started the controversial FaceMash on Harvard University's campus, which allowed users to rank the attractiveness of female students, and it was quickly taken down. Facebook began as a Harvard-only network before expanding to all EDU mailed email addresses and taking hold on campuses nationwide. And its major shift came in 2006 when it opened to users older than 13 and it introduced the news feed, followed by the debut of the Like button 3 years later. And it was in 2012 when Facebook went public with a valuation of $104 billion. That was the largest tech IPO at the time. Hoffman, who teaches a course about technology and politics at the University of Delaware, Hoffman said, quote, "It was seen as rather cute and non-problematic. There was this utopian vision of what these online spaces could be, a place to hear different perspectives," unquote. Or, as Meyer put it, quote, "It was a happy place built around relationships, and people were excited about the novelty of the whole thing," unquote. Well, what began as a digital networking platform for college students has since evolved into a space more commonly used by parents and grandparents, as many younger users have migrated to apps like TikTok and Snapchat and Instagram and Yik Yak. In his sessions, Meyer asked audiences to compare their current Facebook sharing habits to the site's early days. He estimates that 90% admit to sharing significantly less. He said, quote, "The regular person is sharing less, and professionals and influencers are sharing more than ever. It feels like people have taken a step back from being a participant to being a spectator. They are an audience, a valuable audience," unquote. So with a multi-generational customer base, Meta's reach is substantial, with Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp each having billions of users. But with great power comes great responsibility. The benefits of connecting people globally remain as potent as ever, and this impact is felt across the spectrum, from daily interactions between neighbors and friends to historic shifts like the Arab Spring, when Facebook served as a catalyst for the pro-democracy uprisings across the Arab world. But at times, all of that has faded due to scandals and controversy. Major eruptions of pushback against Meta include the Cambridge Analytical scandal in 2018, when the unauthorized harvesting of personal data from up to 87 million Facebook users was used for political advertising, adding to criticisms that the site pushes divisive and extreme political content. Then in 2025, the Federal Trade Commission filed suit against Meta, accusing the company of illegally monopolizing the personal social networking market through its acquisition of Instagram and WhatsApp. Meta won the case, avoiding a likely court-ordered breakup of their empire. A 2021 Wall Street Journal investigation, which was known as the Facebook Files, exposed internal documents showing Meta's awareness of the societal harms caused by its platforms. That leak was provided by whistleblower Frances Haugen, a former product manager who later testified before Congress. And soon after that, Facebook was rebranded Meta. And in March, Meta was dealt courtroom losses on back-to-back days in a pair of possible landmark cases. In New Mexico, Meta was found liable for violating the state's consumer protection laws and failing to protect children from sexual predators. And then in California, Meta and YouTube were both found to be negligent in the design of their apps, failing to warn about their dangers and harming the plaintiff. Broader pushback has followed, including Australia's landmark 2025 ban on social media for users younger than 16. That's prompted other nations to consider similar crackdowns. That scrutiny intensified in 2026 when a major Los Angeles trial accusing Meta and Google of deliberately designing addictive platforms that harm children's mental health. When social networks like Facebook's are created, Hoffman believes, quote, technological philosophers are absent, unquote. Now, Hoffman described a technological philosopher as, quote, a person in the room who says, could this have negative consequences we're not expecting? Because that's what we're seeing, unquote. Then Mir followed up and said, quote, these platforms have evolved, not for the better. Instead of seeing what your friends are sharing, you see what the algorithm thinks you want to see based on the content, not the creator of the content. And that can be quite addictive. It has become less social and more about media, unquote. Now, Meta's future and the digital tentacles that reach into our daily lives will be shaped by several factors, including its massive investment in artificial intelligence, which could eventually supplant social networking with AI-curated content. Zuckerberg said in an earnings call with investors in early 2026, quote, we started with text and then moved to photos when we got phones with cameras, and then moved to video when mobile networks got fast enough. Soon we will see an explosion of new media formats that are more immersive and interactive, and only possible because of advances in AI, unquote. Meta also is heavily involved in its Orion brand augmented reality glasses, which have built upon the success of its Ray-Ban Meta glasses. Orion brings the digital experience of the phone to the physical world with large holographic displays, quote, placing 2D and 3D content and experiences anywhere you want, unquote, according to the company, and allows it to, quote, anticipate and proactively address your needs, unquote. Well, aside from technological advances and transformation, new regulations, such as measures banning news on social media, or new age restrictions, it could restrain parts of its business in some countries, and a successful pending FTC appeal antitrust ruling could force divestitures. Could any of these bans or lawsuits be a tipping point for major changes for Facebook and Meta? Well, Hoffman is pretty skeptical. Quote, how many times has Mark Zuckerberg been on Capitol Hill? We have had these moments over and over and over again. We have become numb. The way we use these technologies is what shapes them. We determine what decisions companies make based on our behaviors. As long as we're engaging with it and getting rewarded by it, and companies are making money off it, it will just keep going. It would take a mass revolt to change, and I don't think that's going to happen. And that was the article, Monetizing Social Media. The other article at the bottom of the page of the economy section is entitled, Survey Says Working During College Can Help Job Hunt. This was written by Medora Lee for the USA Today. It's true, work does beget work, according to a survey by the job website ZipRecruiter. Work experience can often predict whether a college graduate lands a job out of school, the survey showed. Working during college more than doubles the graduate's odds of landing a job, 81% versus 40%. And that's after ZipRecruiter found, after surveying 1,500 students who graduated last year and 1,500 who will graduate this year. In a slowing job market where the share of entry-level positions is shrinking, competition is fierce among graduates, the report said. Knowing what makes a graduate stand out to employers can make a difference in landing a job, it said. ZipRecruiter's report said, quote, in a tougher market, outcomes are not random. More competition for entry-level roles means employers can be more selective about who they choose to fill them. Data shows that the single strongest predictor of post-graduation employment is whether a student worked in any capacity during college, unquote. Now, work experience also speeds up the time it takes to get a job, the survey said. Quote, the advantage of work experience compounds. Working during school builds a resume, but more importantly, it accelerates the entire job search timeline, unquote. So, when employers looking to hire for entry-level positions, they expect they will have to do some training, so they're looking at whether someone can do a job and hold it down, said Corey Stahle, S-T-A-H-L-E, senior economist at the job site Indeed. Corey said, if you worked, showed up day after day, and did a good job, businesses take that as a signal you are a potentially good worker, unquote. Business organization skills were among the most sought after. Indeed found that after analyzing 3,000 job postings in the last 3 months of 2025, customer service ranked 37%, administrative was 35% skills led among the most desired business operation skills that companies wanted. Students who work during college also tend to begin their job search before graduation, 73% versus 43%, and they are twice as likely to have a job lined up even before graduation ceremonies, 20% versus 12%. The type of degree you achieve can also matter when looking for a job. Liberal arts majors are likely to be the most disappointed with their job prospects. Many of them, quote, wished they had pursued more scientific or quantitative fields, unquote, the report said. Almost 17% of English literature or journalism majors waited 6 months or more before landing a job. These graduates also accepted, on average, 30% less in pay than they had expected. In contrast, nearly a third of nursing graduates had secured a job before receiving their diploma, and they also landed the highest median pay at $70,000, saying their earnings were 16.7% more than they had anticipated. Nearly half of those about to graduate in 2026, that's 48%, and 56% of the 2025 graduates are already considering more school as an alternative to a traditional job. The ZipRecruiter report said, quote, graduate school could be functioning as a hedge against a tough market as college grads look to buy more time before entering the traditional workforce. And that was the article, Survey Says Working During College Can Help Job Hunt. At 20 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the sports pages. Our first article on the sports section is D-backs fall to Cubs, Vargas extends hitting streak, written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic out of Chicago. During games, Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovullo normally remains on the side of the dugout nearest to home plate. But after the fourth inning at Wrigley Field on Friday, May 1st, he ventured to the far side, where his players were descending the stairs. He had a message he wanted to deliver. He yelled loudly, and only a few feet away from Todd Walsh, the team's television reporter, "Wake the expletive up!" Asked about his short outburst after his team's 6-5 loss to the Chicago Cubs, Lovullo said he was glad to see his players claw back from a 5-run deficit, but he remained bothered by the plays that put them in that hole. He said, I'm proud of the way we fought back, but I'm still pissed. I'm not going to lie to you. We've got to be better. We've got to do things up to our standard. The Diamondbacks remain a winning club, their record at 16-15. But the past week and a half have not been their best. Losers of 7 of 10 games. Their starting pitching, especially, has struggled. Zach Gallen kept that skid alive with a rough outing against the Cubs. But there were two plays that seemed seared into Lovullo's mind as he spoke to reporters after the game. The Diamondbacks allowed a run-scoring hit on a pop fly to shallow center, a ball that should have been caught. And they gave up an extra base on a throw that went to the wrong base. Both of those plays involved center fielder Alec Thomas, who entered the day as, objectively, the club's best defender this season. Lovullo said, quote, "We talked about all the things that took place in our pregame, in our advance, and we just gave them extra outs and extra runs. And when you do that, you lose one-run games," unquote. Ildemaro Vargas extended his hitting streak to 27 games, and he finished with 4 hits and a walk in 5 trips to the plate. Geraldo Perdomo blasted a 3-run home run to cap a 4-10 4-run rally in the 6th inning. But the Diamondbacks came up empty in the final 3 innings, producing only 1 base runner. For Vargas, he now owns the second longest hit streak in Diamondbacks history, trailing only Luis Gonzalez's 30-gamer from back in 1999. It now is the longest ever hitting streak for a Venezuelan-born player. It eclipsed Wilson Ramos's 26-game streak back in 2019. Gallen needed 95 pitches to record 11 outs. He gave up 6 runs on 7 hits and 3 walks. It was an outing that fell in line with the rest of the rotation in recent weeks. Over their past 11 games, Diamondback starters have logged only 44 2/3 innings. They have given up 50 runs, all of them earned. They have permitted 76 hits and 24 walks, which works out to more than 2 base runners per inning. In other words, it has not been pretty, and it has led them to lean heavily on their bullpen, and in recent days make regular roster moves in order to replenish it with fresh arms. Lovullo said, quote, "We're in the cycle right now. Every team goes through it," unquote. The Diamondbacks entered the day with a rotation that had posted a 5.13 ERA through the first 30 games of the season. That ranked 13th out of the 15 teams in the National League. It's not the sort of results that any club would want from its starters. It is especially troubling for a Diamondbacks team that has spent handsomely on its rotation. The club currently has 6 starters on its active roster, the 5 in the rotation, plus Brandon Pfaadt, who was bumped to a long relief role last month. It also has a right-hander, Corbin Burns, on the injured list and hoping to make a return in July. The six on the roster are making roughly $75 million. Add in Burns, and the number jumps to almost $110 million. Gallen said, quote, "I think it's a combination of we're just not executing, and we're playing teams that make you pay for not executing. By no stretch of the imagination do I think this is representative of the talent and the guys that we have in this clubhouse on all sides of the ball." Lavulo had reason to be upset about the fundamental mistakes. The Cubs already had two runs home in the first inning when Carson Kelly hit a pop-up to shallow center field. Vargas, the second baseman, drifted back. Thomas ran in, came to a stop, and the ball fell. Thomas said, "I felt like he was under it, so I pulled up." And that just wasn't the case. "I think next time, just go after it and call him off. We just had about a meeting about not giving free 90 feet, and that was an example of a free 90 feet that ended up scoring, I think, a run. And that's on me." And that was the article, D-backs fall to Cubs, Vargas extends hitting streak. Our next article from the sports section is about ASU football. Six things that will impact ASU football in 2026. This was written by Michelle Gardner for the Arizona Republic. The fourth set of spring football drills in the Kenny Dillingham era is in the books. Now, in many ways, this April was more important than the others because of the number of holes to fill with the Sun Devils graduating most of the players who drew the bulk of the playing time from a team that went 8-5 in 2025. So here are our takeaways from spring football drills this season. Number one, true freshmen excelled. Nowadays, it's hard for true freshmen to have an impact right away because programs can pluck an experienced player from the transfer portal who is more game-ready, plug and play. But this is easily Dillingham's most talented group of true freshmen. Among the true freshmen with stellar showings was running back Cardae Mack, defensive lineman Julian Hugo, defensive back Daquan Dunn, and quarterback Jake Fett. Now, they may not start, but they could find their way onto the two deep, which says a lot about their potential. Hugo was perhaps the biggest surprise and was singled out by Dillingham on multiple occasions. Number two, the skill positions have depth. The running back and wide receiver groups are loaded. Whoever emerges as the starting quarterback will have good weapons with which to work. Sun Devil fans have become accustomed to a single back in the backfield, Cam Scadabo, Relique Brown. But Dillingham says there's a good chance they will run many plays with a two-back set. Senior Kyson Brown looks fully recovered from the sprained ankle that sidelined him last season. Jason Brown is picking up where he left off in the Sun Bowl. And then there is Mac. And transfers David Abbott and Marquis Gillis. That's just the beginning. Wide receiver transfers Omario Miller and Reed Harris headline a talented crop. Each can do damage. And they will go in with a quarterback not fixated on just one weapon. Our number three item is the quarterback battle will extend to fall. There are four quarterbacks vying for the starting spot vacated by the graduation of Jeff Sims and the departure of Sam Levitt. The lone returning player is redshirt freshman Cam Dyer, who was rehabbing a torn ACL sustained at the end of his high school career for much of the 25 season. The true freshman, Fett, is joined by two transfers in Kentucky's Cutter Bowley and Michigan's Mikey Keene. The latter is a product of Chandler High School. None of the four separated themselves from the rest of the pack, although it appears to be Bowley's job to lose. What might be the most interesting battle is who emerges as QB2. Then there's a renewed emphasis on special teams. This was the weak spot last year. Aside from place kicker Jesus Gomez, special teams play was depressing. How did the Dillingham look to remedy that? Well, he brought in an extra coach for starters. Former NFL punter Mike Siffries was brought in to assist special teams coordinator Jack Nudo. Nick McClarty, a towering 6 foot 7 inch punter, was brought in to challenge incumbent Canyon Floyd, who was slowed by a quad injury last season. Austin PA transfer Carson Smith was brought in to succeed Gomez as the kicker. He didn't appear to have quite the distance Gomez had, but there wasn't a not long enough body of work in the spring to judge that. And then number five, we've got injuries to watch. Several players missed some or all of spring drills with injuries, though most of them were minor. The biggest injury was that lower leg injury sustained by senior tight end Kamari Anderson in the penultimate practice. With Shimon Mateer and Cameron Harpole graduating, Anderson looked like the starter, but that could be in jeopardy. Dillingham said he hopes to have Anderson back by the time the games roll around, but there's not enough information the last time he met with the media to have a definitive timeline or an exact diagnosis. And Georgia Tech transfer Tana Alo-Tupola, the likely starter at center, he injured his knee and he missed the last few practices. Given how the ASU offensive line fared last season after Ben Coleman was injured, there should be some concern if Alo-Tupola isn't healthy come the fall. And finally, the Sun Devils have more size and length. This team has more mass than any Dillingham has had, and that was by intention. Dillingham has said that to move big, strong people, you need to have bigger, stronger people. Now, one place where size appears obvious is the offensive line. The newcomers there include junior Jarmaine Mitchell, 6 foot 8 inch, 310 pounds, freshman Rob Lapuahu, 6 foot 6 inch, 335 pounds, and Oklahoma transfer Luke Baklenko, 6 foot 6 inches, 313 pounds. And among the key defensive additions are end Emarion Winton, 6 foot 5 inch, 247 pounds. That's a transfer from Baylor who could help with the pass rush. And that's the article by Michelle Gardner, 6 Things That Will Impact ASU Football in 2026. We're at 33 minutes past the hour. It's time for us to move on over to the Viewpoint section and read some opinion pieces. On the front page of the Viewpoint section, there's a big, makes up the whole page. It looks like either a comma or maybe it's a quotation mark, but it's all in white and the text is over it. But at the tail of the comma, you know, it could be a tornado. The tail of it is wrapped in barbed wire. And it's entitled, Two Views of Arizona's Anti-SLAPP Law. The first one is, we must defend Arizona's law protecting free speech. And this was written by Greg Leslie, a guest columnist. Arizona's anti-SLAPP law is, plain and simple, an attempt to protect First Amendment interest by demanding greater proof of non-vindictive intent by those seeking to punish acts that involve expression. SLAPP, S-L-A-P-P, is an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. The Maricopa County Attorney's effort to have the anti-SLAPP law struck down relies on a very basic declaration of about the separation of powers among the three branches of government. As all of my constitutional law students learn in their first year of law school, the most important and interesting elements of the separation of powers doctrine are not in how the basic powers are obviously divided, but in how the Constitution allows for, encourages, and even downright demands a plethora of checks and balances on those powers. The powers themselves, minus the checks on their use, are almost always too broad to exist without some limits in a democratic system. For example, the leader of the executive branch, whether a governor at the state level or the president at the national level, of course, has great discretion in the exercise of its executive powers, and yet every important official in that branch is approved and confirmed by the legislature, and every executive action taken is subject to review by the judicial branch, by those prosecuted. These limits are built into the system for good reason. At the time of the debate over the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, James Madison, in Federalist No. 47, wrote about not needing to see complete separation of powers in the document. Quote, "If we look into the constitutions of the several states, we find that, notwithstanding the emphatical and in some instances the unqualified terms in which this axiom, the separation of powers, has been laid down, there is not a single instance in which the several departments of power have been kept absolutely separate and distinct." Unquote. Think of how the legislature's decision to encode First Amendment protections in the prosecutorial decision-making process makes the entire system better. It does not intrude on the day-to-day actions of a prosecutor's office, but only comes to life when suddenly underlying constitutional protections are affected. While Rachel Mitchell mentions her respect for the First Amendment, I firmly believe that those with prosecutorial powers do not always appreciate how their actions can intimidate and silence those who simply want to speak out and participate in the democratic process. Anti-SLAPP advocates are not saying a judge should review the thought process of every prosecutor. It is only when that immense power risks trampling the fundamental intellectual freedom rights of people entangled in the law enforcement mechanisms that the interest in free expression demand that additional issues must be considered by a judge before imposing criminal penalties on individuals. Furthermore, this concept of allowing restrictions on power is hardly new. In addition to common rules against vindictive prosecutions, there are also national protections in place that in principle do exactly what the Arizona law does. But they are cumbersome and incredibly expensive for individuals to use, thus becoming almost unworkable in the context of typical law enforcement and speech incidents. Those are what we call Section 1983 civil rights actions. That uses the statute number from a provision of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, dating back to the post-Civil War Reconstruction period. It was given new life in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, after the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, made it clear the law applied to anyone whose constitutional rights were violated by state and local officials and governments. Arizona's anti-SLAPP statute just moves this important remedy to an early part of the criminal case to get the action dismissed, not to a separate stage in civil court after years of prosecution and litigation that may or may not have ended in an adequate remedy. Remember that Arizona's anti-SLAPP law is a unicorn in the legislative world. It represents an unusual experiment in the area of First Amendment protections. The 39 other states with anti-SLAPP laws protect First Amendment rights in the civil lawsuit context only, libel, invasion of privacy as such suits. But Arizona's 2022 amendments to a narrow law that only protected speech before a public body, like a city council, took the statute from one of the nation's narrowest to definitely the broadest, giving those protections to individuals in any legal action, and that includes criminal prosecutions. Arizona is the only state to have an anti-SLAPP law that applies in criminal trials. But it's important to remember that the law simply imposes a greater burden on prosecutors to continue with a criminal case when free speech rights are involved. It does not automatically lead to dismissal. It simply makes prosecutors show that they did not act in order to deter, prevent, or retaliate against the moving party's exercise of constitutional rights. So, The intent of the state's actions becomes important, and it seems preposterous to me to suggest that even when a prosecution is advanced because of the exercise of free speech rights, there should not be greater protections for the speaker. Arizona's solution, to allow for early dismissal rather than just post-trial civil actions, is downright revolutionary in this context. We should do all we can to make sure our state upholds its unique law, and we should encourage other states to look at our solution and consider adopting it themselves. The principle is simple and essential. Government actions that do not properly respect the First Amendment issues at stake in public activities must be subject to a meaningful review by our courts. Speech rights are not just a pretty bauble that lets people speak on any topic. They are an essential protection in the political process from government overreach against the people who seek to be their own governors. I'd rather stick with a careful approach to checks and balances on all government power, and when that means protecting the First Amendment right to engage in protest or question what the government is up to, we simply cannot and should not have to leave the discretion to wield extensive government powers to the whims of government officials, even those subject to the verdict of the ballot box, and even when they promise to use them fairly. The American experiment with democracy cannot depend on a promise by those in power to do the right thing without giving the people some way of holding them in check. And that was the opinion piece by Greg Leslie. Greg Leslie is the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic. He teaches constitutional law at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Before coming to Phoenix 8 years ago, he spent more than 20 years as the legal defense director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in Washington, D.C. Well, we're almost out of time for this section, so I can't give you the other side of the opinion piece. I'm going to skip over to the letters to the editor section because we have a time for maybe one or two quick letters. The first letter goes like this. On April 25th, a crazed gunman with the intent of killing Trump administration officials and possibly the president himself attacked the annual correspondents' dinner in Washington. Thankfully, he was subdued before he could kill or injure anyone. Later, President Trump gave a message to the world regarding this incident. He was quiet, subdued, polite, and gracious. He thanked law enforcement, and he thanked all the journalists present. He, might I say, almost sounded presidential. Less than 24 hours later, Trump reverted to the same ugly, ill-mannered, disrespectful, and rude individual he has always been, and apparently cannot help himself from being. In an interview with the veteran 60 Minutes journalist Nora O'Donnell, Trump called her a nasty, disgraceful, and rude reporter. It was shocking and jaw-dropping, to put it mildly. What was O'Donnell's crime in Trump's eyes? Asking Trump tough questions that he did not want to hear or have to respond to. And we wonder why ugly political violence is becoming a pandemic. Signed, Antonio Morales Jr. in Glendale. In the April 26th Arizona Republic viewpoint section, Stephen Richer says he doesn't like politics taking the fun out of everything, including personalized state license plates. He says he doesn't like the government picking winners and losers, which I can get behind. And then he uses the example of Charlie Kirk's supporters not wanting to see public money going to Planned Parenthood plates. Well, if enough people want a certain plate, then so be it. The market will dictate the winners and the losers of personal choice. Only the left seems to worry and fret about this nonsense. The right simply wants choice, and let the rest take care of itself. Signed, Charles Lopresto in Phoenix. And we're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, so it's time for us to move on over to the entertainment section. And we will begin by reading today's horoscopes. If your birthday is between March 21st and April 19th, that means you were born under the sign of Aries. Here is your horoscope. Are you following a contrarian impulse? You are disagreeing just to disagree. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th. Woke up on the wrong side of the bed today? Well, moodiness lingers through the morning. For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st. Your need for distance is not the problem, but how you demand it might be. For Cancer, birthdates from June 22nd through July 22nd, mentally prepare for curveballs. A wrench has been thrown into routines. Be willing to pivot. For Leos, birthdates from July 23rd through August 22nd, are you lone wolfing it? Your instincts scream for you to break from the pack. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you acting on your instincts? They may not be entirely accurate. Urgency is unnecessary. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd, are you receiving unsettling news? You cannot ignore what has been revealed. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, are you retracting an offer? You cannot do everything yourself, even if you think you can. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, are you having a moody morning? Well, avoid taking a loved one's behavior personally. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, are you retreating into your shell? Introversion is inspired, but this influence will be short-lived. And Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, you are torn between following the herd and breaking from it. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. Don't be hasty. Pushing boundaries at work may not get you the attention that you are hoping for. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. First letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my daughter, Aline, 40, has gone from crisis to crisis since childhood. She can go from kind and generous one minute to vindictive and mean the next. She's easily triggered into rants, hurling the most hurtful words that she can come up with. Men move in and out of her life on a regular basis. I'm sure that Aline would qualify as mentally ill, but she insists that she's too smart to go to therapy. She knows more than they do. I have become exhausted dealing with her. She believes everything is my fault. I'd walk away if I could. Aline has 3 children, 11, 17, and 25. She treats them like possessions and makes grand promises one day and reverses herself the next day, declaring them unworthy. The oldest moved out at 18 and has never looked back. He's had a difficult time due to the emotional damage his mother inflicted on him. But now he's in a stable situation, thanks to support from me and his uncle. My concern at this point is with the younger two. All I can offer them is emotional support. But they are suffering. Because the abuse is not physical, there seems to be little else I can do. Any suggestions on how to help me and them deal with this? Signed, Grandma Protector. Abigail responds, Dear Protector, your daughter's middle child will be 18 in less than a year. Could that grandchild live with you or their adult sibling until they figure out what they want to do about the rest of their education or future employment? As for the youngest, is their father in the picture? I agree their current living situation is not emotionally healthy, but the question is, how involved is he willing to be? Depending on how disturbed your daughter is, custody of the 11-year-old may be transferable. A discussion with a family law lawyer may help you resolve this. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, My boyfriend passed away 15 months ago. I have been devastated ever since. He was my best friend, and I'm having a hard time letting go. He said he would love me even in death, and when he died, he took a large piece of my heart with him. I know I'm depressed. How do you move on without your best friend? Signed, Hurting Heart in Georgia. And Abigail responds, Dear Hurting Heart, please accept my sympathy for the loss of your boyfriend. Moving on, if that's what one would call it, doesn't happen all at once. It happens in stages, two steps forward, one step back, until we become accustomed to the pain. Your love for each other will not fade. Your boyfriend will be in your heart as often as you need him. But at some point, you will be able to move forward and perhaps find love again, if that's what you wish for. If you have not had grief counseling, the time has come for you to join a support group or to consult an individual therapist. Both can be very helpful. Don't forget that Dear Abby, the column, is written by Abigail Van Buren, also known as Jean Phillips. The column was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. And you can contact Abigail one of two ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter, and you can mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Well, now it's time to take a look at some comic strips. And in the Sunday comics, the first one is Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman. In the first frame, Jeremy is sitting on the bumper of his van. And his girlfriend comes up and says, The van is back! And he goes, Crazy, right? In the next frame, he's explaining to her, My dad found a guy to totally rebuild it after the truck smashed it. And then in the next frame, she goes, It's amazing! And then she opens the door and looks inside. She says, Everything looks and sniff, ooh. And then she steps out of the car and goes, Smells exactly the same way. She does not look happy. And Jeremy doesn't seem to notice it and says, The attention to detail is impressive. And that was Zitz. And then there's Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. And Private Beetle has got a Jeep from the company, and he's in front of the self-service gas station, and he's putting gas in it. In the second frame, he's looks like he's putting oil in it, in the engine. He's got the hood up. And in the next one, he's wiping the windshield with a wiper. And then in the next frame, he's putting air in the tires of the Jeep. And in the next frame, he's at the self-serve coffee counter. And in the last frame, he's at the self-checkout. And the guy behind the counter says, Thanks for shopping at Quick Stop. Could you fill out a short survey? Oh, I don't think Beetle's going to want to do that. Anyway, that was Beetle Bailey. Then we have Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. Blondie's at the door. Dagwood's getting ready to go to work. He's heading towards the door. He's got his briefcase in his hand. And he says to her, Are you okay, honey? And she turns and says, Yes, but I'm just not in a work mode today. So they step out and they're at the front door. And she says, I'd rather be shopping, as he gives her a kiss. And here comes the mailman. And he hands her the mail and says, I'd rather be working on my stamp collection. And then the next frame, Dagwood's in his carpool. And one of the people in the carpool says, I'd rather be playing with my pooch. And the other person says, I'd rather be sunning. And Herb is thinking he'd rather be playing golf. And so finally, Dagwood gets to work and he says, Sheesh, does everybody wish they were doing something else? Uh-oh. In the last frame, Mr. Dithers is looking at the first quarter earnings and they've been going downhill. And he says, I'd rather be making money. And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, Hammy's shooting paper wads up into the basket on the wall, and he hears his mom go, ah! And so he runs in the other room and he goes, what's wrong, Mom? And she says, there's craft paint all over the carpet. Do you know how it got there? And Hammy looks at it and says, well, I've got a guess. And looks down, climbs down on his knees, hands and knees, gets closer to the paint, says, Wren probably got this jar of purple paint out of my art supply box, tripped, and accidentally spilled it right here. And then his little baby sister goes, nuh-uh. And in the last frame, Hammy has run out of the room, slammed the door, and said, Wren can defend herself. And his big sister says, the free ride is over. And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Who is celebrating today? Oh my goodness, singer Frankie Valli turns 92 today. Singer and guitarist Christopher Cross turns 75. Bassist Bruce Hill with REO Speedwagon, he turns 73. Singer Mark Morrison turns 54. Christina Hendricks, the actress, turns 51. Actor Noah Monk turns 30. Rapper Designer turns 29. And actor and singer Rachel Ziegler turns 25. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You've been listening to the second hour of the Reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 3rd, 2026. Have a great day.